I wonder what your biggest insecurity is. What's the area where you feel most inadequate? Where's the place in your life where you lack confidence? Maybe a better way of asking that question is, if you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Most of us, I'm sure, can probably think of something about ourselves that we would change. For many people, it's to do with their appearance. A lot of us don't like the way we look. We think we're too fat. Maybe we think we're too skinny. You know those people who tell you that no matter what they eat, they can't put on weight? I don't know about you. I don't really like those people. Because if I look at a chocolate bar, I put on weight. Maybe we don't think we're pretty enough. We don't like our nose. We don't like our teeth. We're balding. We'd like to have more hair. Appearance can be a huge insecurity for people, and that's why the cosmetic industry is so huge. That's why people are flying off to Turkey to get hair implants and gastric bands and all that sort of stuff, because we want to look better because we're insecure about our appearance. Another insecurity is thinking that you're not smart. You're not educated enough. You're not intelligent enough. You know, you're sitting at a table and people are talking about the geopolitical situation in the Middle East, and all you're thinking about is who's going to be voted out of Love Island this week, or what colour you're going to paint your nails tomorrow. And if you're a guy, that's not what you should be thinking about, because we're not that sort of church. People are insecure about their age. I was having a conversation with Becky there a few weeks ago. We're saying something about in 10 years from now. We were just kind of dreaming about what life would look like. And I went, Becky, in 10 years I'll be 58. And if you're older for 58, this isn't anyway. But for me, this was this moment, because I still feel like I'm 27. And at this moment of clarity where it's like, oh my goodness, I'm not as young as I used to be. Wrinkles, sagging skin. You're not able to do some of the things you used to find easy. Your body and your brain sometimes just don't function like they used to. You've got more grey hairs. In fact, you've just got more hairs in places that you didn't used to have hair. Little crevices in your nose and your ears. Hairs start to grow. You end up going to the toilet more at night than you used to. This is getting uncomfortable, but that is me right now. Twice a night is a good night. Maybe loneliness is your insecurity. Maybe everybody else seems to have more friends than you. Maybe your friends are getting married or engaged and you're not. Maybe everybody else seems to be having a better social life. You go onto social media and everybody's just having their best life ever. Everybody's at a party, everybody's out having a social life, and you're sitting at home watching repeats of Friends on Netflix. And social media hasn't helped this, because social media, everybody seems to be having a great time apart from you. Everybody's highlights are better than your regular life, and they have more friends, followers, and likes than you have, and you feel like Norman or Norma, no mates. Parents can have insecurities. Every parent in this place at sometimes feels like they're the worst parent in the world. Every parent at some stage feels like they're destroying their children. Every parent feels like every other parent is better than them, and that everybody else's kids are better than their kids. And we can have all these insecurities around parenting. For some people, often men, it can be insecurities about your job, your income, your status. We look at other people and they've got nicer cars, they've got nicer houses. We want the nice house. We want to provide well for our families. For me, honestly, for me, one of those little niggling insecurities is I've never owned a house. Ever. We don't own a house. I've never owned a house. I'm 48 years old and I've never owned a house. And if I'm being really honest, that's always been one of my little insecurities. We would love to buy one and we're hoping to buy one, but we've never done that. These are just a few of the insecurities we feel. Now, I guarantee some of you have experienced some of them, and most of you have experienced many of them. And sometimes as you get older, they do go away. Sometimes as you get older, you grow into your own skin a little bit. You become just more comfortable in who you are, and you stop really caring as much about what other people think. But then there's insecurities that never go away. There's insecurities that seem to follow us throughout our lives. And these insecurities are the ones that can stop us from doing the things that God has called us to do. These insecurities are the ones that cause us to say no when we know we should say yes. That cause us to hide in the background when we know God is calling us forward. And that's what we see with Moses. Last week we encountered Moses with his insecurities. And 40 years before this, Moses was brought into hiding because he had killed an Egyptian. And in his place of hiding, he had become deeply insecure. And God is now calling him out of hiding, but Moses is much more comfortable in the background behind the scenes. God says to Moses, I want you to go to Egypt, I want you to go to Pharaoh, I want you to go back to the place where you came from, and I want you to say, Pharaoh, let my people go. And back then, 40 years ago, Moses was so full of self-confidence and passion and bravado, but now he's incredibly insecure. And he has this argument, this back and forth with God about why God is making the wrong decision. And he's trying to convince God that he's not the man to do what God is asking him to do. The first thing he says, verse 11 and 12, is who am I that I should go? I'm a nobody. I'm a has-been. I'm just nothing. Nobody's going to listen to me. I'm past it. And then he says, what if they don't believe me? Verse 4, verse 1. What if they don't believe me? What if they say the Lord didn't appear to you? What if? What if? Most of our fears begin with what if. The enemy loves to whisper, what if? What if this doesn't work out? Or what if they? What if they laugh at you? What if they mock you? What if they talk about you behind your back? You know, there's something about us that has this real fear of people talking about us, of people criticizing us. What if? Most of our fears begin with those two words. What if this happens? What if it doesn't work out? We create imaginary stories in our head, scenarios that aren't even based on reality, but they're normally the worst case scenario. It's not going to work out. What if? What if nobody listens to me? I've tried this before. What if they reject me again? I don't like rejection. What if? Then 4 verse 10, he says, I'm not a good speaker. I've never been eloquent. I'm slow of speech. I'm not very articulate. I stumble over my words. Some of you feel like that. I could never stand up and speak. I could never share my faith. I'm not very expressive. I don't express myself well. And then 4 verse 13. Eventually we get to the bottom line. Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else. There's other people who could do this better than me. There's other people who'd be much more gifted than me. Why don't you send them, Lord? But please don't ask me. Moses is saying basically, God, I don't want to do this. I don't have what it takes. Please send somebody else. He's completely overwhelmed by the task. You know, it's funny. 40 years before this, Moses was overconfident. He thought he could do anything, and now 40 years later, he's having this crisis of confidence because of failure, because of rejection that happened back then. And failures in our past and mistakes in our past will do that to us. There's things that we replay in our minds over and over again, even though it happened years ago. And even though everyone else has forgotten about it, you can't forget about it. And every now and again, something triggers it. It's funny, there's things I did and things I said years ago that nobody cares about anymore. And yet every now and again, I'll have this replay in my mind. And I'll think, what was I thinking? Why did I do that? And so he's got this failure, this rejection in his mind from the past. And he's riddled with insecurity and inferiority. But sometimes also age will do that. Sometimes as you get older, you just don't want to take as many risks. Sometimes as you get older, you just get more comfortable and you want a safe, settled, predictable life. And things that you would have said yes to in your 20s and maybe your early 30s, once you get into your 40s and 50s and 60s, you just think, that just feels like too much work right now. Even though you might even have more time at that stage, it just feels like you've become more aware of your weaknesses and you're not so sure of yourself anymore. But as we said last week, the problem here is this. It's still all about Moses. 40 years before this, it was all about Moses. It was all about his confidence. It was all about his ability. 40 years later, it's still all about Moses. It's all about his lack of confidence and his feelings of inability. And the point is this, it's not about how good he is or how bad he is. It's about God going with him. That's what God wants him to understand. It's not about him. Yes, it is in one sense because he's the one who has to go. But God says, if you go and you obey, I'll do the heavy lifting. If you go and you obey, I will do the miracles. If you go and you obey, I will protect you. I will watch over you. All you need to do is obey me. You handle what you can handle and I'll handle what you can't. You do what you can do and I'll do what you can't do. And that's the way God tends to work. If you can do it, he probably won't. I've said this before. I used to say to Elijah when he would ask me to do things, he'd say, will you tie my laces? And I'll say, if you can't do it, I won't do it. But I'll do the things you can't do. And I think sometimes we're asking God to do things that he has actually called us to do. And God would say, if you can do it, I won't do it, but I will step in if you obey, and I will do the things that you can't do. And for Moses, the bottom line is he just doesn't want to do it. It's not that he doesn't know God's will. God's will is clear. God has made it incredibly clear to him. It's not that God has been ambiguous. It's not that God is kind of just like, just not giving him anything. God has been really clear. Go to Egypt, confront Pharaoh, do this, 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 and this. So it's, the issue isn't guidance. The issue is obedience. And sometimes isn't it the same for us? Yes, there are times when we struggle to know God's will. There's times when we need to hear a word from God. There's times when we have a decision to make and we say, God, I don't know what to do here. And that's legitimate. And it's important to seek God. But then there's other times when we do know what God wants. And the issue isn't that we don't know his will. The issue is this. We just don't like it. We don't want to do it. You see, God's will is really easy to obey if what God wants and what I desire are the same thing. It's really easy to be a Christian when God says go this way and I was already wanting to go that way. But when God says go this way and my heart's desire is to go that way, that is when we really determine who God is to us. That's when the rubber hits the road. Clarity isn't the issue sometimes. Obedience is the issue. And the problems happen when God's word spells out clearly what we're called to do, but our desires are pulling us somewhere else. When God has made it really clear what he wants us to do, but we want to do something else. God says, you're not to date this person. And you say, God, but have you seen them? Look at them. I'm never going to meet anyone like them again. And God's saying, you're not to date them. They're not the right person for you. They're not going to lead you the right direction. I have been there, folks. When God says, I want you to leave a place. I want you to move on from here. And you're saying, God, I'm comfortable here. I love it here. I want to stay here. When God says, I want you to give this. And you're saying, I want to hold on to it. That's when we struggle. And when God's will and my desires collide, here's what typically happens. One of two things happen. The first one is this. We ignore him. And we hope that he changes his mind. And we get on with our lives and we're disobeying him. But we're just going through the motions. But what happens is our hearts begin to get more distant from God. And our hearts begin to get harder because God convicts us. His spirit convicts us. And we don't like conviction. And so to avoid conviction, we avoid God. And we begin to drift further and further from God. And we lose our way. And we become miserable. And we become frustrated. And the Christian life becomes boring. And it becomes hard. And we get stuck in the Christian life. And we wonder why things aren't working the way that they used to. And eventually we get further and further from God and end up at a place we never wanted to be. And we wonder why. And maybe that's you today. Maybe you're finding yourself at a place in your Christian life where there's frustration and you feel stuck and it's just not working like it used to. Maybe it's because God is speaking to you and you know what you're called to do, but you're just not doing it. And God isn't going to change his mind. The second thing and the better thing to do is to bring your decisions and your will and your life into line with God's will and desires. It's costly, it's hard, it's painful. But when you make a decision, I am going to do what God wants, things turn out better. It's just the way it is. Obedience always brings blessing from God. Always. Even reluctant obedience. God would rather have reluctant obedience than disobedience any day of the week. Obedience always brings God's blessing into our lives, and disobedience to God always lifts his favor off our lives and makes life harder. And here's the thing, God will not force us to do anything. God wasn't forcing Moses. Moses had a choice, but his choice wouldn't just have impacted him. His choice was going to impact 1 to 2 million Hebrews in Egypt. And his choice was going to impact every generation from then. I mean, you think about that. If those Hebrews hadn't been delivered from Egypt, how history would look completely different. And so often we think our decisions are just about me. They're just about my comfort or my life or my walk with God. But actually, I want to say to you, your decisions in relation to obedience to God have much more far-reaching consequences than you could ever imagine. You are here today because of decisions that parents made, grandparents made, Sunday school teachers made, youth leaders made, generations past. I was with our youth and kids leaders the other night, and I felt really prompted to say this to them: what you do matters. What you do matters. You're not just volunteering just once a month to teach the kids. You're impacting them for eternity for Jesus. You know, I didn't go to church much as a kid, but I went to Sunday school and youth group. And you know what? I can't remember one single thing they taught me, but you know what I do remember? Their character. I remember their heart. I remember their Christian character. And that's what impacted me. What you do matters much more than you realize. And when we think about a gift day next week, it is so easy just to go, well, it's just an annual gift day. We do this every year. Let's just... No, it's not. What you do is not just about the gift day. It's not even just about this church right now. It is about future generations in this community. It's about your children and your grandchildren. It's about your great-grandchildren. It's about young people and old people coming to know Jesus Christ. I became a Christian when I was 15 because people served and gave. And because that changed my life, we are raising a Christian family. We're impacting people. If people hadn't served back then, I wouldn't be doing this now. And I think it's really important that we see beyond our small lives and realize that when we give, when we serve, whatever we do for Jesus is not just about this immediate moment right now. It is so much bigger than that. You know, we had 45 teenagers, young people, at Hope Youth last week on the first night. That's incredible. I want to see that grow. But you know what each one of those 45 young people are? They're people who are going into schools where they're being taught all sorts of things about the world and about sexuality and about morality. I want to see those 45 or whatever it becomes, young people go in there as disciples of Jesus Christ who speak a different truth, who speak the truth of the Word of God. I want to see them grow up and meet Christian boys and girls, men and women, and get married and begin to raise Christian families and have Christian children and begin to impact this community. It is not just about this. It is so much bigger than this moment. It is about the generations that are to come. I want us as a church to see beyond just this next 12 months or this next 3 years, to look to the future and say, what are we building that's going to last beyond ourselves? But we have a choice. We always have a choice. God doesn't force us to serve. God doesn't force us to give. You know, somebody say this recently: Christians don't tell lies, they sing lies. And what they said is this: we sing songs like Jesus All for Jesus and I Surrender All. And we mean that until we don't. We mean that until God asks us to do something we don't want to do. And then it becomes Jesus Most for Jesus. I surrender 96%. Because it's really easy to sing those songs and get caught up in the moment. And I love those songs and it's important to sing those songs. But are they actually speaking the truth of our lives? Or are they just nice songs that we're singing? The Christian life is not just about having Jesus as your Savior. We have reduced it to that in the West. It is about having Jesus as your Lord and your King and your Master. It is not just about praying a prayer, going to the front of a meeting, raising your hands. I have no problem with any of those things, but those things are not found in the Bible. It is about saying to Jesus, I want you to come into my life and I want you to be my Lord and my King, and I give everything over to you. We have reduced the Christian life to something that it was never meant to be. And that is why we have people who claim to be Christians who never live any sort of a godly life, but they prayed a prayer once and asked Jesus into their heart. Can I say to you, that is a fallacy. That is not the gospel. The gospel is this: are you following Jesus today? Jesus said, follow me. You know how you're following him? If he turns around and you're behind him. If he's in front of you, if he's leading the way, you're following him. Becoming a Christian and living the Christian life is making Jesus Christ Lord over everything. Jesus said this, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." The Christian life is about surrender. It's about submission. It's about service. It's not just a free ticket to heaven. Yes, salvation is free. Salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, and Christ alone. But the Christian life is costly. And if your Christian life never costs you anything, you probably need to go back and ask some questions. It's about following Jesus every day of your life. It's not just about an add-on on a Sunday. It is about him being Lord over every area. And obedience is costly. And that's what Moses will learn. Even reluctant obedience is better than disobedience. But he's not quite ready to say yes yet. And so God asked Moses three things, and I'm going to go through these quickly, and that'll be us. God asked Moses three things in Exodus chapter 4, but they're important for everything that happens in this point forward. And the first thing he asks is this: what is in your hand? What is in your hand? Look at what it says in verses 1 and 2. Moses answered, "What if they don't believe me or listen to me and say the Lord did not appear to you?" Then the Lord said to him, "What is in your hand?" "A staff," he replied. "What is in your hand?" And Moses looks down, and what he has in his hand is a stick. It's a shepherd's rod. It's a staff that he carries every single day with him. He uses it when he's climbing up steep hills. He uses it to fend off predators who are coming after the sheep. He uses it to lead, guide, and direct the sheep. There's nothing special about it. It's just a dead, dry piece of wood. It's a visible symbol of his job. It's his identity. When people see this man with a staff, they know what he does. I was up visiting somebody in the Royal the other day, and for one of the few times I was wearing my clerical collar, folks, you would have been proud of me. You wouldn't have recognized me. But when people see me in that, they know what I do. And when Moses had his staff, they went, "This guy's a shepherd." They knew what he did. The staff was also a sign of Moses' mistakes and failure. 40 years before this, Moses was living in a palace, and he wasn't carrying a shepherd's staff. He was holding a royal scepter. And so the staff, the wooden staff that's in his hand, is a sign and a symbol of how far he has fallen. It's a sign of his failure. And now he's been reduced to the lowest job in the culture, from a royal scepter to a shepherd's staff. It was also a sign of his income. The staff was a sign of how he made a living. It was how he put food on the table for his family. This was his job, working with sheep. So the staff was just a stick, but it was more than this. It represents his identity, his income, his journey, and his failure. And I think God would say to us today, to all of us, what is in your hand? And some of you are thinking, well, I've got my phone in my hand, I've got my Bible in my hand, I've got the hand of the person beside me, hopefully that's your husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend, if it's not, remove it. What have you got in your hand? What have you got in your hand? What have I given you? What have I blessed you with? You know, I've had different jobs throughout the years, and one of the things we did periodically, and some of you will know this because some of you work in places or you have your own business, you do a stock take. And what you're trying to determine is what inventory you have, because sometimes you think you've got certain things and you don't, and sometimes you have things that you didn't realize you have. You do a stock take. And what you're doing in the stock take is you're saying, what have we got? And I believe God is saying to some of us, in fact, he's saying to all of us, what have you got? What inventory is in your life? What are you overlooking in your life? What have I given you? What gifts, abilities, and talents do you have? What resources, finance, and assets have I blessed you with? What people, relationships, and connections are in your world? What education and experience do you have? What about your health? What about your struggles and failures even? Don't ever overlook those things. We overlook so much because we don't think they're important, or we take them for granted. Like Moses' staff, it seems too ordinary, nothing special. Or we compare ourselves to others and we think we got shortchanged. We think they're really gifted, they're really talented. I really don't have much. I must have been at the back of the queue when the gifts and the talents were being given out. We compare our worst to their best. We compare our weakness to their strength. We compare our failures to their success. But notice what God doesn't ask. He doesn't ask what is not in your hand. Because often we're more aware of what we lack or where we're deficient than what we actually have. He doesn't ask, what do you not have? Nor does he ask, what does someone else have? He says, what do you have in your hand? Right now, right here, today, what do you have? Not even what would you like to have, what do you have? Because God always starts with who you are, where you are, with what you have. God always starts where you are, who you are, with what you have. And you know what it always ends up? Not looking like enough. Not looking like very much. You see, in the Bible this happens. Elisha meets a widow. She says, I've got nothing. He says, what have you got in the house? She says, nothing, just a little oil. Pour out the oil. And she keeps pouring and pouring and pouring, and it gets her out of debt. Starts with what she has. Jesus has got a crowd in front of him. What have we got? Well, just a few loaves and fish. And he feeds 5,000 men, plus women and children. God specializes in taking a little and making it a lot. But we need to acknowledge what we have. And so the first question I want to ask you is this. What do you have in your hand? What have you been overlooking? What has God given you? What have you not been acknowledging? What have you not been appreciating? What do you have in your hand? The second thing God says is this. Will you let it go? Look at verse 3. The Lord said, throw it to the ground. Throw it to the ground. God says, release what is in your hand. Relinquish it, surrender it, lay it down before me. And that seems like no big deal if it's just a stick, but don't forget this is Moses' identity. This is Moses' income. He always had it in his hand, and God says, let it go. I don't know about you, I get attached to things. There's things that I have and things that God gives me and he blesses me with that when I first get them, I hold them loosely. But then over time, I begin to hold them more tightly because they become part of my identity and I begin to think I can't live without this. For me, honestly, one of those things I ask myself is ministry. 20 years ago this week, I began training for ministry. And it's so much of my identity and it's so much of what I do. And I've had to ask myself, what if God were to ask me to lay this down? I would find that really hard because I've become incredibly attached to what God gave me. But he gives and he takes away. And there's things God has given you and they're gifts from him because every good and perfect gift comes from him and it's a blessing from him. And when you first got it, you realized it was from him, but now it's yours. And you become like a kid and you begin to hold on to it really tightly. It could be your home, your car, could be a job, a hobby you love, it could be a relationship. What if God said, I want you to let that go? I want you to let that go. Again, it's much easier to obey God if you wanted to let it go in the first place, if it wasn't that important to you. But what if you really, really want to hold on to something and God says, I want you to let it go. I want you to give it away. I think sometimes we fight for dear life to keep it. Let me talk about my own life. And some of you will have heard me talk about this before. But I think it's important when I talk about money and giving that I don't stand up here as someone who hasn't struggled with this. I think I've always had, and I've talked about this a little bit before, I've always had a bit of a poverty mentality. I've always felt like I don't have enough. I've always felt like others have more than me. And I've always felt like I can't give because I just am afraid of lack. I'm afraid of not having enough. And this followed me into my Christian life, and it even followed me into my ministry. And I was ordained 16 years ago, and I was a curate in Shankill Parish, not far from here. And there were times when my boss, the rector, would ask me to preach about giving and tithing, and I did it. But you know what the embarrassing thing is? I wasn't practicing it because I really struggled with it. And so I would get up and I'd preach a great sermon. It just wasn't reflected in my life. And the Holy Spirit constantly convicted me about that. And I constantly rejected the conviction. And I knew I had to give. But here's what I kept thinking. I need that money. And I started to think of the things I could use that money for. I mean, if I were to tithe, that's what, £250 a month or whatever it was. That's a lot of money. Especially when you don't own a house, that could help towards a deposit for a house. normally took me on holidays, but just being honest, but I really wrestled with it. And so here I am talking about money. I believe that you should give. I believe you should tithe. But I'm not doing it. And we had some sort of project. I can't remember what it was. And we were going around every home in the parish to talk about the project and their giving. And it came to the road I lived on, and I was the only church member on the Lock Road. And somehow the rector looked at it and saw how much I'd been given. It was actually how little I'd been given. And he pulled me aside, and very gently and very graciously, he challenged me. And can I say, I was embarrassed, I was humiliated to be ordained 2 years probably at that stage, maybe three. But I'm so thankful. I am so thankful. From that day forward, I have been faithfully tithing. And can I say, I would never go back. I would never go back. And giving started as a duty and a discipline, and it's become a joy. And generosity over time becomes a joy. And yes, sometimes that fear comes back, and sometimes that poverty spirit creeps back, and you know how you push against it? You give more. And the thing was this, that when I wasn't giving, I never had enough. Even when I was single and I was on a decent salary as a cure, it was like sand going through my fingers. I never had enough. But when I started to give, I was able to get out of debt. I was able to save. And I don't know, but here's what I've discovered. And just please go along with me in this, because this is my experience. When you're faithful in giving your 10%, and faithful in generosity, God blesses the 90%. But when you hold on to the 100%, you don't have the blessing of God on it. And I would rather give and have God bless the rest than keep and not have his blessing on it. And I've got to the point where I fear God too much not to give. And I actually, there's a degree of self-interest in it at this point where I actually just, I can't imagine not giving, because I love living in the blessing of God. And this is not a prosperity message, folks. Please hear that. It's not giving you'll get a Lamborghini, okay? That is not what we're saying. But the Bible is very, very, very clear that when you give, you're sowing seed, and God will cause that to grow into a harvest. Sometimes it's material, it can be in other ways, but you will never outgive God. And so I want, as Morris Elliott and Jeff, I think it was Jeff Wilson actually at the time, gently challenged me about my giving 13, 14 years ago, I want to gently challenge you. Some of you know you need to give. Some of you know you need to give more. Some of you have pulled back in your giving. And I am not saying give as you're not able. God didn't ask what's not in your hand. Please do not get into debt. If you're going through a hard time, we totally get that. This is not me laying a guilt trip on you. I am not anyone to lay a guilt trip on anyone. You've just heard that. What I am saying is this. Maybe God is gently challenging you today to step forward and to say, I haven't been given the way I should. I'm going to put that right this week, right now. It's sacrificial. You have less money in your account, but you're also giving God control of your finances. And when you give God control, he becomes your source. He becomes your provider. Something is released when you start to live a life of generosity. I have never met that I can think of miserable, generous people, but I've met a lot of miserable, stingy people. Because it's not just a money issue. Where your treasure is, there your heart is. And there's something that is released in your heart. There's a joy that comes through generosity. So don't block the blessing of giving. If God says release it, don't hold it back. Because the truth is this, everything comes from him. It's his anyway. One of my favorite stories is of a woman who was at an airport waiting on her flight. And she went and bought a bag of Maltesers. And she sat down beside a man she didn't know, and the bag of Maltesers was sitting in between them on the armrest. And as they're sitting there, the man beside her who she doesn't know reaches into the bag of Maltesers, takes one out and eats it. And she looks at him. She can't believe this. But she doesn't say anything. So she reaches out and she takes one and she crunches it as loud as she can. And the man smiles at her. And a few minutes later, the man reaches in and he takes three Maltesers out of the bag and puts them in his mouth. Well, she is livid. She reaches in and takes four and puts them in her mouth. She's fuming. It gets to the stage where there's one Malteser left. And what does the man do? He has the nerve to pick up the bag and offer her the last one. And she snatches the bag, gets up and goes off and gets onto the plane and sits down and goes to take a book out of her bag. And in her bag, she notices she's got a full bag of Maltesers. All along, they were his. And everything we have is his. Everything. If we honestly say Jesus is Lord and King of our lives, it's all his anyway. When we give, we're not giving ours, we're giving him back what's his. It's an issue of ownership. We are stewards. He is the owner. And what we're simply doing is giving him what's already his. And we need to settle that in our hearts. Yes, you might have earned it. Yes, it might have come in a paycheck from your company. But ultimately, he gave you the ability to earn that money. He gave you the breath in your lungs. He gave you the ability and the skills. He got you that position. It's all his anyway. You're just giving him back what's already his. It all comes back to the lordship of Christ. So God says, firstly, what's in your hand? Secondly, will you lay it down? And finally, as I finish, pick it up. Pick it up. Moses threw it to the ground and it became a snake and he ran from it. Then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake and it turned back into a staff in his hand. So Moses throws it down and it becomes a snake. And I don't know about you, I wouldn't like that. I don't like snakes. They give me the heebie-jeebies. My son likes snakes. Look at this. Have I got it there? We should have a slide. That's a year ago and that's a few months ago. The kid is not fazed by snakes at all. The second one there on the right, he only got uncomfortable when it started to wrap itself around his neck and tighten. And then he decided it might be better to get rid of the snake. Okay, that's enough. I get the heebie-jeebies with snakes. And so Moses runs from the snakes, the snake. What is going on here? Why does God turn the staff into a snake? I think there's a few reasons. The first one is this. God is saying, I'm able to transform something ordinary into something extraordinary. It might be plain. It might be ordinary. It might be old. It might just be dead. But I am able to take something that is plain and ordinary and I'm able to transform it. And Moses, you might feel unqualified. You might feel too old. You might feel useless. You might not feel gifted enough. But I can take you in my hand and I can transform you. I think that's the first thing he said. The second thing is this. God is showing that, well, here's a better way of expressing it. In Egypt, Pharaoh, the symbol of his power, the symbol of his, where he derived his power, the god was a serpent. Sometimes you'll see pictures of Pharaoh and he'll either have this big cobra neck made of gold or a crown made of a cobra, like a cobra. And so the power and authority of Pharaoh was derived from the serpent, was derived from a snake. It was a symbol of his power. And that explains what happens next. Moses runs away. I don't blame him. I would run from the snake. But this is also a picture of Moses running from Pharaoh. This is a picture of Moses running for 40 years. And God says to him, pick up the snake by the tail. Now, anyone who knows anything about snakes knows you don't pick them up by the tail. You pick them up by the head. Because if you pick them up by the tail, the head can swing around and bite you. But God says to Moses, pick it up by the tail. Pick it up, Moses. What God is saying is this, confront your fears. It's time to stop running away. For 40 years, you've been running from this. You've been avoiding this. And I want you to take hold of it. I want you to handle it. And I think that's a word for some people today. There's things that you've been avoiding. There's things that you've been running from. There's conversations you've been avoiding. There's people you've been avoiding, and there's a blockage in your life because of something that happened that you haven't handled or you haven't dealt with or you haven't confronted. And I believe God would say, I need you to handle that. And if you confront that, you will start to move forward. I know God's been challenging me about some things. Some things even in the past that happened that I've kind of brushed under the carpet and I've forgotten about. And even this week, God has been telling me, you need to deal with that situation. You need to contact that person. You've never resolved that. And it's not that I'm walking around with some big issue in my heart. It's just there were some things that were never resolved. And I believe in this season, if we're to advance further into what God has for us, there are some things that we've never dealt with that he's calling us to confront. There's some things that he's calling us to face up to. And that can be difficult and that can be painful because you've been running away from it for a long time. But you won't advance or progress or move forward until you take hold of that. And God says to him, I want you to take hold of this. I want you to go back to Egypt. And I know it might seem dangerous, but I will protect you and you will see my power at work. Your obedience and your faith will place you under my protection. And so Moses picks up the snake and it's transformed into a staff again because when Moses obeys, God protects him. And back in his hand, the staff looks exactly the same as it did before. It's wooden, it's old, it's ordinary, it's dead. There's nothing special, but look, there's something I want you to see as we finish. Look at verse 20. So Moses took his wife and his sons, put them on a donkey, and started back to Egypt. And he took the staff of God in his hand. At the start, this was Moses' staff. And it looks the same, but it's now the staff of God. And this staff, if you keep following through the book of Exodus, this staff is responsible for miracles. When he stretches it over the River Nile turns to blood. When they get to the Red Sea and they can't cross it, he stretches out the staff and the waters part. When they're thirsty in the desert and there's nothing to drink, he strikes a rock with his staff and water comes flooding out of it. When they're fighting the Amalekites, he holds the staff above his head. As long as the staff is above his head, they have victory. This staff, this ordinary staff, when it's submitted and surrendered to God, becomes the staff of God. And is able to do things that it was never able to do before. And when you take what you have, your gifts, your talents, your abilities, your resources, your relationships, everything, your time, everything God has given you, when you're willing to submit and surrender that to God, it looks the same, you look the same, but God empowers it. God almost, it's like a glove. God puts his hand in it and he empowers it to do things that could never happen before because you're willing to submit and surrender it to him. And so what I'm asking you, and I'm going to just be really direct, I'm asking you to look at what you have, to look at what God has given you, and to ask yourself, what am I willing to give? And if it's your first time here, here's the temptation to think, oh, I came to church first time, they're always talking about money. Can I say to you, this is the one talk of the year that I talk about money. And I do it unapologetically because money is a discipleship issue. But I'm going to ask you, as you consider the gift day next week, to consider, what have I got? And you know what, if you're getting things really tight at the minute, that's okay. And if you're getting things really, really tight, talk to us and we will help you. This is not just about us taking, please. If you've been around here, you know that. That's not our heart. This is not a pressure thing. I will never know what you give, okay? I will never know what you give. I don't look at that. I don't want to look at that. I never want how I treat anyone in this church to be in any way impacted by what you give. I made a determination in my heart when I came here 7 years ago or whatever it was, and I have never looked at what you give. I want you to know that. I have no idea what you give. So this is not about doing something that I'm going to say. It's not about doing something that other people are going to say. This is about God saying, what have you got? What are you willing to submit? And what are you willing to surrender? And what's the point? Why are you giving? Well, I've already talked about the work we do here is funded by you. I think some people have said to me, is there not some like central pot, you know, some big fund somewhere that this all... No, everything we do in Hope Church comes from your giving. Nowhere else. All that we do with our young people, all that we do in outreach, all of that comes from you. And God is at work among us here in Hope. I really believe that. I hope you do too. In the last year, we've seen God at work. We've gone deeper. We've gone deeper in fellowship as we've had home groups and different groups meeting. We've gone deeper in prayer. We've gone deeper in the worship and the presence of God, and we're going to keep pushing into all of that. There's so much more, but we want to go deeper in our local community. We want to go deeper in reaching people. Young people, older people, the lost, the lonely. We want to reach people. That's why we've employed a community and youth pastor. We want to go deeper. We want to reach people outside the church walls. And folks, yes, we still need a bigger building. I know I've been talking about this for years. I think the first time we started talking about this was 3 or 4 years ago. Let me update you where we are in that as I finish. Essentially, when it comes to a building, we have three options, okay? The first one is this: buy a piece of land, draw plans, get permission, and build. And we have looked at that, and we are looking at that, but that is at least a 3 to 5 year process. But that's a possibility. The second option is this: find a retail unit, a warehouse in the area here, and buy it or rent it and move in. That's my preference. It's always been my preference. I make no apology for this. Some people have different ideas. I would love us to find somewhere and move in, put up some walls. That's the quickest way. Here's the problem. There's nothing coming up. We have looked at some places, and either the rent was so high or the management fees were so high, but we're going to keep looking. And there's not a building or a space within 2 miles of here that we haven't looked at as a management team. I don't want you to think we're sitting on our hands. We are incredibly proactive. And there are places that we're continuing to look at right now. So there's build from scratch. There's an existing building, which isn't there at the minute. The third option is this: what have you got in your hand? And it's this space. And this space right now isn't big enough. I see people are sitting right at the very back. That's been the case the whole time. This place hasn't been big enough for a long time. We built the shed, 2 years ago? That has been such a blessing. Imagine if we didn't have that right now, where our youth and kids meet. Holds 80 people. But this space is not big enough. And so what we're looking at, is there something as an interim measure, a 3, 5, 7 year measure that we can do in this building, because we like this location, that we can do in this space to increase our capacity. And we have drawings, not to increase the size of this room, but the room where the creche is, to build out the back and side towards the fence, where we could increase it to 300 seats plus. That's one option that we're looking at. And so I am putting all of that before you. There's obviously a cost in that. It might feel like we're wasting money. We don't know how much it's going to cost. We will bring that before you when we do. But we're looking at plans. We're praying that God will give us a space right now or very soon that we can move into quicker than that. But we can't sit on our hands for the next 3 years and do nothing. And so that's one of the things we're looking at. We don't know how much that's going to cost to do that. There's also a parking issue that we will need to look into. Some of you are very aware of that. Just get here early. But I just want to put all of that before you. As a church, we're moving forward. As a church, we are so thankful for what God has done. But we're also believing for so much more. Particularly in two areas. One, a greater sense of God's presence among us. That's the underlying priority in everything. I don't want to have a building without God in it. The presence of God is our absolute priority. So that's number one. And the second thing is this: reaching people who don't know Jesus. We haven't seen enough people come to faith. And I want to see lost people come to know Jesus. That's our mission. That's our calling. And that's what I'm asking you to give to. I don't get a thing. I'm not on commission, folks, okay? This is not like that. I'm asking you to give to the mission of the church so that we can reach more people with the gospel. And we are in difficult days. The shaking isn't stopping. And there will come a point, I believe, where people out there are going to be looking for hope. People are going to be looking for answers. And we need to be positioned. And we need to have space. And we need to have resources to draw them to Jesus Christ. And so that's all I'm asking you. Give what the Lord puts on your heart to give. It says, as I finish, in 2 Corinthians, each of you should give what you've decided in your heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion. For God loves a cheerful giver. What he's saying is make a decision. Don't come in next Sunday and rummage through your pocket and see what change you've got. This week, pray. If you've got a spouse, talk to them. Talk to me, talk to some of the management team. Look at our website about how you can give. If you're watching online and you watch us every week, and I know there are hundreds of you who do that, I am going to exhort you, please, to give into our gift day. If you've never given to Hope before, if you're fed by this ministry, I'm asking you to give. But ultimately, this is between you and God, and I will never know what you give. And I honestly, in one sense, it's nothing to do. It's to do with you and God. But I would ask you to prayerfully consider what you give next Sunday. But ultimately, our desire is that his kingdom would come and that his will would be done here as it is in heaven. Let's